Hi, this is Tyson Brown with NSTA Press. This marks our seventh installment of NSTA Press Behind the Books. Today I'm talking with Bill Robertson, the author of Chemistry Basics, Stop Faking It, finally Understanding Science So You Can Teach It, a book that will help you understand chemistry fundamentals from the ground up. Bill, welcome.
Thanks, Tyson. It's good to be here.
Bill, your background is in physics. How is writing a book outside your area of expertise different?
Well, you know, first of all, there is a fair amount of overlap between physics and chemistry, so that's a good thing for me. On the other hand, basically, there's just more to relearn. And when I write a book on physics concepts, there might be a few concepts here and there that I'm a little rusty on and have to brush up my knowledge. When it comes to writing about chemistry, there's just a lot of concepts that I'm rusty on. And it's also a problem of, so basically I have to kind of relearn some of the chemistry material, or in fact just learn it for the first time.
So that sort of puts you in the same position that some of your readers are in.
Very much so. And also, I go through chemistry textbooks and chemistry resources now with a different perspective than I did, say, when I was back in college or high school taking a chemistry course. And the different perspective is that now I search for understanding rather than just kind of accepting a bunch of facts that are thrown at you. That's kind of my main philosophy in writing all my books and in education in general, that you want to understand ideas rather than memorize them. So I find myself, as I'm going through resources, asking, well, now, why does this happen?
Sure.
For instance, why do certain elements, when they get together, why do they form a stronger bond than other elements? And you will get a brief or non-existent answer from a lot of resources. And so I find myself asking, well, why does this happen? And often the textbook or the resource I'm using doesn't give me the answer to the why question. And so what I do is I'm working with a guy named Michael Kralik, who is a colleague. I've worked with him on many projects in the past. He's got a PhD in chemistry, and so he's my why guy. And that when I want those questions answered, I can contact him, and he can help me through a real understanding of what's going on. And so he's a great resource in that regard.
What are some of the ways that he is able to lend understanding to the concepts? Do you do a lot of hands-on work together, or does he just talk you through it?
We pretty much talk through it. I mean, he's over in Salt Lake City, and I'm in Colorado. But he has a great way of providing analogies. And he does, and yes, in the sense of hands-on, he has a lot of great ideas for hands-on ideas that are analogous to things that are going on in chemistry, so that I can actually use those actually in my book. If they help me understand, they're going to help the average teacher understand. Let me give one example. I'm currently writing a second chemistry book, and I didn't understand how hybrid orbitals form. There's different orbitals for atoms, and sometimes they get together and they form new kinds of orbitals. And he came up with this great analogy using soap bubbles, that if you take two separate soap bubbles and you try and slam them together so that they tend to want to occupy the same space, they actually form a new shape that is consistent with the energy of the situation. So he's real good at providing those kind of things and helping my understanding.
These analogous demonstrations, does it also affect the way you have chosen materials for the book? I noticed that you chose things like vinegar and Epsom salts and so on for activities, and I wondered if you were choosing those for any specific reason.
Yeah. In fact, when I do talk to Michael, I say, now remember, we want to use household stuff here. We can't use a whole lot of specialized chemicals. And that's kind of the approach I've taken in all my books, is that when I try and come up with an activity to help someone understand the concept, I simply look around the house for things that I can use, for the things that people would normally have. And, you know, one of the reasons for that is, you know, it's readily accessible. It's not going to be really expensive for them to get materials together to go through the book and actually do the activities. I think there'd be a tendency for the average reader, if they're going through this, they say, oh, you mean I need to buy this, and this.
Right.
They're just not going to do the activity.
Sure.
But if it's something they can walk to the kitchen to or for and, you know, get something, then that much easier for them.
Bill, you spend time in early chapters going over historical explanations for chemistry concepts, explanations from Empedocles, J.J. Thompson, Rutherford. Why is that a useful way to introduce chemistry or any other science?
First, I should mention that if people pick up your average chemistry textbook, the book will begin with kind of a historical perspective on chemistry.
Okay.
But my purpose in doing the historical perspective is generally quite different from what the textbooks do. They just kind of, it's almost like it's a tradition to say, okay, here's how we got to where we are now in terms of who contributed what. My purpose in the historical perspective is to help the reader understand the process of model building. Most of chemistry is creating models for things that we can't see. These things are going on, and we're coming up with scientific models. And, in fact, that's what most of science is about, is building these models. And it just seemed to me the best way to help the reader understand this process of model building, and not just the process of model building, but how it basically answer two questions. And these I attribute to a guy named Arnold Ahrens, who is a great physics educator. And his two questions that he said needed to be answered for understanding were, how do we know and why do we believe? For instance, how do we know that there are things like electrons? Why do we believe in electrons? Why do we believe that there are things called neutrons in the nucleus? And so I took that approach to help the reader get to a point where they say, you know what? I understand this model of an atom. I understand why we think an atom looks this way, rather than just the fact that, okay, here's an atom. Atoms have protons and neutrons and electrons, and there you go, which is the approach that most textbooks, I'm sure the most curriculum materials that the teachers will use, take that approach that, well, here it is, accept it. But I want my readers to understand how we got to that point and how, why we actually believe that atoms look this way.
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is even a point in your narrative where you draw from Empedocles' description of earth, fire, air, and water, and you indicated that in some ways that was a very effective model for explaining why materials have certain behaviors.
Oh, yes. In fact, it amazes me that people ever came up with an atomic theory, because the first theories of atoms were simply as tiny, hard spheres, like marbles or billiard balls. And that is not nearly as effective at explaining physical processes as were the, you know, ancient Greek ideas of, you know, earth, water, air, and fire. And, yeah, in, to kind of get a perspective on the model-building process, what we tend to do is we think, oh, those stupid old Greeks, you know, they didn't know anything. How could they be so dumb? But, in fact, their model was quite good at explaining things. And the early models of the atom were very poor at explaining things. So it's just amazing to me, that process of how we even got to where we are today with atomic theory, when it started off on really pretty shaky ground.
Well, speaking of atomic theory, quantum mechanics is at the heart of a lot of chemistry, but it's widely considered to be a difficult subject. How is your treatment of quantum mechanics different from what people will encounter in other resources?
Yeah, I caught some grief early on from a number of people who said, you're going to explain quantum mechanics to, say, fourth grade teachers? And the answer was, yeah. I liken it to my approach to calculus in my math book. The basics of calculus are quite simple. It's all about change and how things change and approximating certain things. And the basis of calculus are really simple, but what happens when you learn calculus is that the mathematics gets in the way very quickly. And soon the mathematics is overwhelming. And in fact, in many books, many teachers will take the approach of just starting right in with the math rather than kind of the conceptual ideas behind calculus, which is why calculus gets this reputation as being really difficult. And I had a similar reaction from reviewers when I told reviewers, okay, it's very simple. I'm going to devote a chapter in a math book to calculus. And they said, what do you mean? You can't possibly do that. It's way too complicated. So if you now go over to quantum mechanics, the way quantum mechanics is often introduced, usually in the very end of a high school physics course or chemistry course or the end of a college course, it's introduced mathematically. Mm-hmm. And it's abstract, and very abstract very quickly. But once again, the basics of quantum mechanics are quite simple. The idea of a probability distribution, which is when we talk about where electrons are, we can't say definitely where they are. There's this kind of probability cloud. And to understand the idea of a probability cloud, I simply used the idea of making a map in a house of a probability distribution for where someone might be during the day.
Uh-huh.
And that's really accessible to the reader. And if they understand that, then they understand a probability distribution for electrons. They can make that analogy. The example I used was me on Super Bowl Sunday. And so probability distribution was very heavy right around the couch
right.
and then going to the kitchen and every once in a while to the bathroom, but that was about it, right? So, and then I invite the reader to do a different probability distribution for, a different scenario in a house. And then, like I say, there another important idea in quantum mechanics is the idea that energy is quantized, meaning that things have certain, energy has definite values and only certain allowed values. And you can create an analogy for that with waves on a, you do standing waves on a string or a rope, and you see that the standing waves have only certain allowed frequencies. And so you can, they can actually see that happen in front of them and then draw the analogy with how it works in quantum mechanics. So, you know, basic idea, once again, is that the basics of quantum mechanics are not complicated. If you're going to study quantum mechanics in any depth, sure, you're going to have to get into the math pretty quickly and pretty heavily, but you can still get a conceptual understanding without, you know, getting too far into that.
One aspect of getting to conceptual understanding that's, I think, an important part of your writing is your approach to humor. I think it makes the work that much more engaging, and it's a big part of your approach. It appears in the cartoons, the narratives, even in the glossary. What is the font of your approach? I mean, how did you come up with this style of presentation?
Boy, you know what? It just kind of happened. The first writing I did in explaining concepts was in graduate school, and I was a teaching assistant and was writing up notes for the students that are in my discussion sections. I would attend the lecture that they attended, and I'd see areas that really needed further explanation, and I'd write up my own notes, and I'd, you know, use an old the Ditto machine, right? And so rolling with all the Ditto fluid and stuff and rolling them off. And anyway, I made up those notes for all my students. And as I did them, it just seemed natural to let my personality come out. When I teach, when I do workshops, when I teach science classes, I just can't help it. I'm just sort of full of lame humor. And, jokes that kind of go bad. And it's just part of my personality. And so I would say it's just a matter of, when I did this first writing, of letting my personality come out in the writing. And, you know, it's possible to get that out of my writing. In fact, I've worked on a number of projects where, you know, reviewers said, oh my gosh, this is too flip. People won't appreciate this. And so I can make my writing boring. and sometimes that's necessary. And in fact, after I worked on a lot of projects like that, it took me a while to get back to kind of being my normal self. So while you can make your writing boring, what doesn't work is trying to be funny.
Right.
Anyone who's ever written is probably guilty of this. I think everyone wants to try and be Dave Barry. And whenever you force the jokes, then it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so the way the humor comes out is just kind of my natural everyday personality. When I just let that come out, if I'm writing along and I think of some stupid thing or some reference to my past or something that at least a fairly large number of the readers would understand, then I just throw it in.
Yeah, I noticed that there are a lot of inside jokes that sort of come from, you know, different periods in our recent culture.
Yeah, and, if you get the jokes, great, and if you don't, well, you know, ask somebody, and eventually you'll find somebody who understands what I'm talking about. Of course, it might not be worth the effort, I don't know.
Why do you think there's the need for this sort of book?
That question applies to basically all the books in the Stop Faking It series. There's a need for this because the resources available to teachers are very limited. They have books of activities. There's many, many companies that develop books of activities, and they're activities for use in the classroom. And those have very brief, short explanations of the science. The explanations are so brief that you couldn't, if you didn't understand it before you read the explanation, there's no way you were going to understand it after reading the explanation. And so those are available to teachers. Textbooks are available to teachers, but they're pretty intimidating. And so the reason I even started this series was I saw the need for a resource that thoroughly explained underlying concepts, much better than those brief explanations in the resource books of activities, and also less intimidating than your average textbook. So kind of a goal is to help teachers get to the point where if they want to study that textbook, it's not going to be nearly as intimidating because they have a solid conceptual understanding for what's going on.
Does that tie into your instructional goals for the book?
I would say exactly that. The goals are to get the teacher to where they come across one of those brief scientific explanations, maybe full of vocabulary. They can look at that and they understand the science behind it, so they can make sense of that brief explanation. So it's useful for them. In addition to them understanding, then that helps them explain it to the students. Because, you know, I think what happens too often in math and science instruction is the teacher will kind of read and memorize an explanation and then pass that memorized explanation on to the student, where the teacher doesn't have a deep understanding of what's going on. And therefore, the student is unlikely to get a deep understanding of what's going on. So we have this kind of surface thing happening where teacher memorizes something, passes on the memorization to the student, and no one's really understanding the scientific concepts.
You said you were working on another chemistry book. Is that another Stop Faking It chemistry book?
Yes, it is. It's what happened was I got to a certain point in the first book and realized if I covered everything I needed to cover, it was going to be way too long. And so I just kind of stopped at one point where I had a fairly complete set of concepts covered in the first book, and that left just a whole bunch of things to cover in the second one. The second one, in some areas, is going to be slightly more advanced than the first book. Basically, I do assume that the reader understands the concepts that are already in the first book. Mm-hmm. And I do try to do reminders, but expecting that. And also, I am going to have the reader do some activities where they're going to need some specialized chemicals. But we're going to give the reader various resources where they can get these chemicals, either ordering through a school or if, say, they're a homeschooler or just an average person reading this will have some kind of resource for them to obtain the chemicals they need. And it's not going to be anything, you know, too dangerous, I hope.
Will this be akin to sort of the organic chem class versus the regular chemistry class?
Oh, it wouldn't be that drastic a change, because there are some things, for instance, thermodynamics, behavior of gases, that I just didn't address thoroughly in the first book. And so I devote an entire chapter to it, and we've got a great simulation that the authors have allowed us to use, so the reader can go to the internet and use this simulation. But that chapter assumes no knowledge on the part of the reader. And so there'll be enough chapters like that. But then there's some other stuff that is just slightly a bit more advanced. But nothing of the order of organic chemistry as opposed to regular.
Bill, inevitably, teachers are going to want to use some of these strategies and activities with their students. Any advice for teachers who might want to try this?
Yes. Choose wisely. What the reader needs to know, what the teachers need to know when they're going through my book is, and I keep referring to them as readers, they should be doers too, because part of the reason the activities are in these books is for the person reading them to understand the concepts better. So I put these activities in not as activities that I'm recommending for the classroom necessarily, but rather, these are activities that are going to help the teacher understand the science concept. And that's why I ask them to actually do these activities before they read the explanations that are tied to the activities. So I don't really worry about whether this is a proper classroom activity. If I want to use Open Flame, I'm going to use Open Flame because I assume these are adults doing these activities. Now, that said, there are plenty of activities in this book that would be great for classroom use. So all I'm asking the teachers to do is put on a filter and don't automatically assume that if they do this activity in understanding for themselves and in the book, that it's automatically a great activity for the classroom. So they just need to filter that out and just be careful in what they use in the classroom.
Don't blow up the school.
Don't blow up the school. Priority number one.
Bill, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to me today. For more information about Chemistry Basics, Stop Faking It, Finally Understanding Science So You Can Teach It, including a sample chapter on simple models, which feature early explanations for chemistry concepts, go to www.nsta.org and click on the Science Store. This is Tyson Brown signing off from NSTA Press.